If you would, please join me in your Bibles in Joshua chapter 9. Joshua chapter 9. The Old Testament is packed full of stories that teach us about God, that teach us about serving God. They give us both positive and negative examples in our interaction with others and our interaction with God and our treatment as God as well. And Paul says a couple of times, once in Romans 15, and once in 1 Corinthians 10, that the reason that these things were written were for our learning. And the book of Joshua is just rich with accounts of faith and biblical application. And there's a lot of stories that stand out in the mind that we learn from a very young age. We learn of the faith of Rahab in Joshua chapter 2 and in Joshua chapter 6. As we read her story, being the only believing woman in Jericho who sees the children of Israel marching and who sees the hand of God, and she's able to tell something's different. And we see the great battle of Jericho, God's victory at Jericho, as he uses faith and grace to give the city of Jericho an impenetrable fortress to a people who've done nothing to deserve it. You see God's grace and mercy at work there on behalf of the people, and you see faith working as well. You see failure in God's people as you look at their battle with the little city of Ai that they approach. And you see Achan's punishment for covetousness, and we learn the lesson there, why we aren't to covet things that don't belong to us. And so the book of Joshua itself is filled with great lessons of application, great lessons of faith. But I want to study this morning one of those stories that probably for most of us flies under the radar. It's not as well known as the city of Jericho and its battle, or the story of Ai and the failure there on behalf of Israel, or Achan or Rahab. Rather, it's an encounter that takes place between Joshua and the Gibeonites. Now, those of us who may have read through our Old Testament several times or studied through the book of Joshua may be a little more familiar with it. Largely, it's probably cited more as an example. But what I want to do is take a more detailed approach and give our time and our study to this account itself. So let me just kind of provide you with the context before we jump into the story, in case you're not terribly familiar where we are, where Israel is geographically, where we are in their history, to kind of bring you up to speed so that you'll have a fuller appreciation once we start working through the text. We have there before us a map of the land of Canaan prior to the conquest of Joshua. And just going back 40 years, Moses had led the children of Israel out of Egypt, where they'd served as slaves for 400 years. God is ready to give the people the land of Canaan that he had promised Abraham when he said, you're going to one day have a great land and you're going to have a great nation. Well, he has the nation, and now God is preparing to make good on the promise to give them the land of the Canaanites. And so Moses, in preparation for this task, sends out 12 spies into the land of Canaan. And we know how 10 of those spies bring back a negative report. 2 spies, Joshua and Caleb, bring back a positive report saying, yes, there's giants, yes, there's fortified cities, but God is with us, and if we'll trust him and enter in with faith, then he will give us the land that he has promised. However, the 10 spies were able to persuade the masses into desiring to return to Egypt, rebelling against Moses. And so God gives the people what they ask for and says, okay, you don't want to go in and receive the land? Fine, you won't. And so they wander for the next 38 years where that faithless generation dies off. However, in the meantime, Moses leads them to conquer some lands on the east side of the Jordan River. And there is the Sea of Galilee, I believe. And if you go south, runs down into the Dead Sea. They travel, having rejected God, having rejected the conquest into the land of Canaan, they travel on the east side of the Jordan, and they conquer much of the land there that later 2.5 tribes are going to request to inherit. Two notable victories that will play a part in our story are Moses' conquering of the kings Sihon and Og. And those were two giants, not as well known as the giant Goliath, but they were two giants, both, I believe, who were probably taller than Goliath. But Moses leads them in conquering many of the nations on the east side of the Jordan, since they refused to enter into the Canaan land itself, west of the Jordan, and take that. He conquers much on the east side and later gives that to the tribes of Reuben, Gad, and half of the tribe of Manasseh. So, as Moses dies and Joshua takes leadership, they're camped just on the west side, the east side of the Jordan, and they're going to cross, and they're going to enter into the city of Jericho, where they will make war. And we know how that battle at Jericho and Ai goes. And so they're preparing to make war now on the rest of the land of Canaan. So that brings us up to speed for where we are in Joshua 9. So let's just kind of read through this a little bit at a time and have a remark or two to make along the way, and then bring out, I believe, some really rich application from the story. Joshua 9, let's read the first couple of verses there. "Now it came about when all the kings who were beyond the Jordan, in the hill country and in the lowland, and all on the coast of the great sea toward Lebanon, the Hittite and the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite heard of it," that is the conquest of the city of Jericho and Ai, "they gathered themselves together with one accord to fight with Joshua and Israel." So as we were doing our overview of the book of Joshua, you may remember you kind of have the orange line there that breaks west. What Joshua and the army are doing is they are essentially cutting the land of Canaan in half, separating the north and the south so that they can't join forces in a single large coalition and come against the Israelites. So they take Jericho and Ai and kind of split the land of Canaan. So as the Canaanites are able to kind of see the writing on the wall, they realize that Israel is coming in and that they're swooping down on the people, the Canaanite people. They figured that their best bet is to join forces in hopes of defeating Israel. And so you've got all of these nations joining together to make war against God's people. Picking up in verse 3. "When the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai, they also acted craftily and set out as envoys and took worn out sacks on their donkeys and wineskins, worn out and torn and mended, and worn out and patched sandals on their feet and worn out clothes on themselves, and all the bread of their provision was dry and had become crumbled." So word has preceded Israel as they begin to conquer Canaan. Joshua's defeat and God's victory at the city of Jericho was just absolutely epic. Jericho, of all places, was one of those impenetrable fortified cities. It had multiple walls around it, and there's no way in the world that a little wandering band of nomads should be able to take on a city like Jericho and defeat it. Yet word had spread of God's great victory at the city of Jericho. And if a city like that could fall, the Gibeonites realized, well, nobody is really safe at all. So they took a different approach than their neighbors. We have this saying, if you can't beat them, join them. And that's exactly what the Gibeonites are going to try to do in their approach. So with some degree of cunning and trickery, they take old sacks and wineskins that are used. They take patched shoes and clothes and put those on their backs and on their feet, and bread that had become dry and crumbled. And they travel to Gilgal, and they ask Joshua to enter into a covenant of peace with them. We see that in verse 7 down through 13. Joshua 9, 7. "Then the men of Israel said to the Hivites, 'Perhaps you're living within our land. How then shall we make a covenant with you?' But they said to Joshua, 'We are your servants.' Then Joshua said to them, 'Who are you? And where do you come from?' They said, 'Your servants have come from a very far country because of the fame of the Lord your God. For we have heard the report of him and all that he did in Egypt, and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon, king of Heshbon, and Og, king of Bashan." Those are the giants, by the way. "So our elders," verse 11, "and all the inhabitants of our country spoke to us, saying, 'Take provisions in your hand for the journey and go to meet them and say, "We are your servants now then, make a covenant with us." This our bread was warm when we took it for our provisions out of our houses on the day that we left to come to you. But now behold, it is dry and has become crumbled. These wineskins which we filled were new, and behold, they are torn. And these are clothes, and our sandals are worn out because of our very long journey." All right, let's pause real quick. I know that this is maybe hard for some in the back to see, but I'll give you the specs just as we talk about them. The people of Gibeon are right there, and what Joshua and his army are right there at Gilgal. So there's Gibeon, there's Gilgal. That's a distance of about 25 miles. Now, that's a rather long way back in the day. Now we know everything that's happening on the other side of the world, but word hadn't reached the people at Gilgal that these were actually natives to the land of Canaan who have come to them, although they're only about 25 miles away. And in verse 7, you see that the men of Israel, they're suspicious at first. They say, what if you're actually people who dwell from within the land? How would we know? So they expect something of a ruse, and they're a little suspicious, but the Gibeonites immediately redirect them. They go from the leaders of Israel, and they try to make their plea, pitch their sale to Joshua as they go to him, and they say, make a covenant with us. At first, they only want a covenant of peace, but as of peace. But as their situation, they're beginning to realize, is becoming more desperate and more tenuous. Now they offer to serve the people of Israel. And note the touch of flattery there in verses 9 and 10. Listen, your servants have come from a very far country because of the fame of the Lord, your God. For we heard the report of him and all that he did in Egypt, and all that he did with the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon, king of Heshbon, and Og, king of Bashan. So it's really a masterful deception as they begin to butter them up and begin to flatter them. We come from a faraway country, 25 miles away, but they leave that little detail out. We heard of what God did in Egypt. We heard of the exploits with Moses as the leader. And they've even got visual aids. They say, this bread, we left with it warm and fresh, but we've been on the road so long, we've come from so far away, it's now dry and it's crumbling. These wineskins that were brand new, they're now patched with age and use. These clothes and these sandals are now travel worn. Now remember, they had taken all of those things intentionally when they left on their journey. But they've got these visual aids and it sounds convincing as they plead their case. Look at verses 14 and 15. So the men of Israel took some of their provisions and did not ask for the counsel of the Lord. Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them to let them live, and the leaders of the congregation swore an oath to them. Now, verse 14 really resonates as you read that. It says that the children of Israel, the leaders of Israel, took some of the things that they had, but it said they did not seek and they did not inquire of the counsel of the Lord. Back in the boring part of the book of Exodus, chapters 33 to 40, you have some very detailed destruction about the building of the tabernacle, the specs for the tabernacle, and for the garb that the high priest was going to wear. The high priest, Aaron, that was handed down to his sons, who was going to serve as the mediator for all of Israel. There's some very boring details there that talk a great deal about the intricacies of the high priest's garment. Within the high priest's breastplate, there were two stones called the Urim and the Thummim. And what they were is they were means by which the people could inquire of the Lord. And so we don't know exactly how that was done, but hidden there in those details, that's a part of the garb that the high priest wears so that he might have some sort of communication with God. And so when it says they didn't seek the counsel of God, they didn't involve God in this decision that they made. Rather, they took it upon themselves to just make a covenant of peace with these people. And so they made peace to let them live, and the leader swore an oath. Let's pick up reading in verses 16 through 21 and find out the reaction that the people have. They have been duped by the Gibeonites. It came about at the end of 3 days, after they'd made a covenant with them, that they heard that they were neighbors with them and that they were living within their land. And then the sons of Israel set out and came to the cities on the third day. Now their cities were Gibeon and Chapirah, Beeroth, and Kiriath Jearim. The sons of Israel did not strike them because the leaders of the congregation had sworn to them by the Lord, the God of Israel. And the whole congregation grumbled against the leaders. But all the leaders of the whole congregation, we have sworn to them by the Lord, the God of Israel, we cannot touch them. This we will do, even let them live, so that the wrath will not be upon us for the oath which we swore to them. The leader said, let them live, so that they became hewers of wood and drawers of water for the whole congregation, just as the leaders had spoken to them. So 3 days later, they figure out that they've been duped. They travel now to the cities of the Gibeonites that they own, those four cities that I'm not going to try to pronounce again. But it seems like the Gibeonites are something of a relatively large people. They are in possession of these four cities in the land of Canaan. And while they might, on one hand, have been wise to team up with the rest of the people that were preparing to make a stand in war against Israel, they take this different tactic. Now, the people are angry when they find out that they've been duped. The children of Israel are angry when they find out they've been duped. If you want to perceive that they have noble view regarding these people, you might say it's because they're angry that This covenant now prevents them from destroying the people like God had commanded. If we assume their intentions to be less than noble, well, they're angry because there's four cities now that they can't loot and that they can't take the spoils from. So the leaders remind the people, we vow before God not to destroy them. We are bound by this promise. However, we can capture some degree of usefulness. We'll take them and we will make them slaves for our people. And coming from Egypt and having that in mind, they can probably understand, well, there's a certain benefit to having slaves because we came from that. And think of all of the things that were done by the children of Israel while they were slaves. So we'll make slaves of these people just as we were slaves, and we'll capture some usefulness from them, even though we can't do with them what we'd like. Let's finish up the story in verses 22 through 27. Then Joshua called for them and spoke to them, the Gibeonites, saying, "Why have you deceived us, saying that we're very far away when you're living within our land? Now therefore you are cursed, and you shall never cease being slaves, both hewers of wood and drawers of water for the house of my God." So they answered Joshua and said, "Because it was certainly told your servants that the Lord your God had commanded his servant Moses to give you all the land, and to destroy all the inhabitants of the land before you. Therefore, we feared greatly for our lives because of you, and have done this thing. Now behold, we are in your hands. Do as it seems good and right in your sight to us." And thus he did to them, and delivered them from the hands of the sons of Israel, and they did not kill them. But Joshua made that day hewers of wood, drawers of water for the congregation, and for the altar of the Lord, to this day in the place which he would choose. I like how Joshua says to the Gibeonites, "Why do you say that you live far away when you actually lived in our land?" They hadn't conquered the land of Canaan yet, but Joshua speaks, his faith in God speaks in such a way that although he says, "We haven't conquered it yet," you are living in our land that we haven't conquered. His faith in God is so great that he talks about this land as if it were already theirs. Thus he curses them to become slaves, drawers of water, and cutters of wood for the house of God. Now, I must say that I concur with the Gibeonites. Better to be a slave than to be dead free men, I suppose. So they submissively placed themselves at Joshua's disposal, saying, "Do whatever seems right to you." And so he enforces the covenant. Well, you're not going to touch them, but we're going to make slaves out of them. They're going to serve in the people in the house of the Lord. So as we look at this story, I want to bring out four lessons that I think we can benefit as we look at this. The first is this. We've gained the story. Now we want to make a bridge to consider how the story of the Gibeonites and their deception now transition to the world in which we live some 3,500 years later. The first point that I would bring out is beware of Satan's deception. Satan is described as a roaring lion, but he's also described as a cunning serpent. So who's more dangerous, the serpent or the lion? Well, if you look back in the first couple of verses of Joshua 9, you've got this group of armies that are making this united force to come and make war against God's people. There's your roaring lion. And then you've got the Gibeonites who are going to use cunning and craft and deceit to infiltrate and make peace with Israel. Who's more dangerous? Well, the lion is most often noticed. And in the case of the cunning serpent we see here, those are the ones who find their way into making peace with God's people. You know, deception is one of Satan's most effective tools to sway the people of God. Paul, as he's writing to the Corinthians, he says, "No wonder even Satan himself disguises himself as an angel of light." Non-believers will walk foolishly into the mouth of the open lion, but believers are more often enticed by the cunning serpent. So Paul remembers this is how we're to walk. And if only the Israelites would have walked this way, perhaps this story would have had a different ending. Paul says we walk by faith and not by sight. Now that needs to tell us a lesson that the Israelites failed to miss. You can't always trust what you can see with your eyes. They saw old clothes, worn out shoes, they saw dry, crusty bread, they saw patched wineskins. So as they looked at what was before their eyes, they said, "Well, surely this story must be true. The evidence proves it." Well, Satan promotes sin oftentimes under the label of what may appear good to the eyes, to the way that the eye sees. Love is love. That's an argument that we often hear made in defense of homosexuality. And so it takes on the mantle of good, it takes on the mantle of love, and some people who have a failure to understand love as it's given for us and defined for us in the Bible might on the surface say, well, this is something good. It looks good in my eyes, therefore it must be good. You know, some might say, well, a piano makes better, the music sound better. And so from the surface, you've got something that may appear to improve the way that we worship God. Some may say, well, hot dogs and hamburgers do a great job of filling the building up. And from one perspective, as we look with our eyes, as we look carnally, and as we look at what we see, something may judge these things to be good. But the question is, when we walk, not by sight, but when we walk by faith, are they? And we might find a very different answer if we look beyond what we can see with our eyes and look at it through the eye of faith in light of God's Word. And that's why we're given this admonition, the Thessalonians were rather, and which we would seek to apply, examine everything carefully, hold fast to that which is good. I like the New King James phrase. It says, test all things. And this is where Israel failed. And this is where we've got to do better. Satan will seek to infiltrate us through deception, and we prevent that by testing those things that seek to make their way into our midst. We use God's Word, we open it up, we walk by faith, and not simply by sight. And that's an important lesson. Beware of Satan's deception. Secondly, we see that tragedy often occurs when we fail to seek God's Word. Look back at verse 14 of Joshua 9. So the men of Israel took some of the provisions and did not ask for the counsel of the Lord. God gave a very specific instruction to be dealing with the people of the land of Canaan. When you go back to Exodus 23, this is His command before they enter in. He says, my angel will go before you and bring you into the land of the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Canaanites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, and I will completely destroy them. You shall not worship their gods, nor serve them, nor do according to their deeds, but you shall utterly overthrow them and break their sacred pillars in pieces. And so, the command was, destroy these nations completely. Now look in Joshua 9 and verse 7. The men of Israel said to who? The Hivites. The Hivites, when you look back at Exodus 23, the Hivites there was one of the nations that the people were commanded to destroy. And so by divine decree, these people should have been put to death. This wasn't a heartless mass slaughter. This was God's judgment on people who took and who sacrificed their children to idols, on nations who ran rampant with terrible sexual immorality. This was judgment for one, but this was also the fulfillment of a promise. Secondly, we don't need to look at this and people will say who want to undermine God, this is heartless slaughter. Why would He do this? No, understand this is judgment of God on behalf of these people. And this was also for the preservation of Israel. That's why He said you are to destroy them, you're to tear down their altars, their sacred pillars, and break them in pieces, otherwise they will entice you and you will fall into idolatry. But rather than doing what God had commanded, did Joshua enters into a covenant in peace. What was his mistake? Well, verse 14 was his mistake, where it says, they did not ask for the counsel of the Lord. And this isn't the first time this has happened. Think back to the city of Ai, where after defeating the great people of Jericho, they thought, well, Ai is just this little bitty city. We can take them on. And so they approached the battle of Ai with human wisdom. Joshua says, just send 3,000 troops down there and we'll be able to conquer that little city. Once again, they don't invoke God's interests, God's perspective. And so human reasoning sets in. They go to Ai. They get beat down. They get ran out of town. And so this isn't the first time that human wisdom has been given precedence and preference over divine wisdom. And we see the mistake here taking place in the parlay that was made with the Gibeonites as well. So we have this admonition for us in Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him, and He will make your path straight. And such is the way we need to walk in this world. Tragedy occurs when we fail to bring God's Word, God's wisdom, God's decrees into the decisions that we make. And we may find our lives often broken and dealing with unintended consequences if we walk by faith in human wisdom, sight and human wisdom rather than by faith bringing God into the equation of our decisions. We also see that faith and fear lead to salvation. Now, while this is very bad for the people of Israel, from the other perspective, from the Gibeonites' perspective, this is very good. And I would say you have overtones of the gospel being taught here for us in this story. Does this story, did it sound a little bit familiar? Think back to Joshua 2, the story of Rahab who is praised for her faith. Now note the similarities between Rahab and the Gibeonites. Both of them were natives of Canaan. That is, they were decreed to be destroyed completely, both Rahab and the Gibeonites. Both were confident that God had given the people of Israel the land. Rahab makes a statement in Joshua 2:9, I know that the Lord has given you the land. And it rings very clearly with what the Gibeonites say. Because it was certainly told your servants that the Lord your God had commanded his servant Moses to give you all the land. So there's this expectation that God is giving the Israel's God is giving that people the land. These people acted in fear and faith along with Rahab. And for those jotting this down, we're kind of running through this quickly. I can get you the references if you like those after the lesson. But both Rahab and both the Gibeonites acted in fear and faith, where Rahab says, you know, I believe that your God is God in heaven above and on earth in earth beneath. And the Gibeonites, we feared greatly. Fear was what motivated them to act with faith. And that's why we have done this thing, because they believed God was giving the people the land, and they were pushed by their fear to act with faith. And both act with cunning to secure refuge and safety for their people. We know how the Gibeonites did, and we know how Rahab did by taking the spies in and then sending the men of Jericho and the servants of Jericho out the other way to protect them. So do you see the similarity? Rahab is praised for her faith. And from the perspective of the Gibeonites, you have to admire this act of faith on their behalf as well. Finally, we need to realize and recognize the weight of our word. I want to close the passage in 2 Samuel 21, if you want to flip over there real quick, because this is not the last time that the Gibeonites make an entrance into the story of the Bible. 2 Samuel 21. God commanded that Israel destroy the Canaanites, and rather than destroying them, Joshua enters into a covenant with peace. This was a very strong vow. When the people were angry, when they realized what's been done, the elders or the rulers of Israel say, we can't do anything to them now because we've made a vow before God. Essentially, we have sworn to our God that we are not going to harm these people. We've sworn by the Lord, and now we can't touch them. To kill them would to be to take God's name in vain. It would be to go back on the word that they had made, the promise that they had made when they invoked God's name, offering these people peace. And despite disobeying God and making peace and not destroying them, this is significant. Listen, God expected them, even though they disobeyed his prior command, God expected them to honor their oath. How do we know that? 2 Samuel 21. Over 400 years has passed since this oath has been made. David is king, and there's this situation in Judah. Look in the first few verses of 2 Samuel 21. Now there was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, year after year, and David sought the presence of the Lord. And the Lord said, it is for Saul and his bloody house, because he has put the Gibeonites to death. So the king called the Gibeonites and spoke to them. Now the Gibeonites were not of the sons of Israel, but of the remnants of the Amorites. And the sons of Israel made a covenant with them, referring to the one we read about in Joshua. But Saul, 400 years later, had sought to kill them in his zeal for the sons of Israel and Judah. Thus David said to the Gibeonites, what should I do for you? And how can I make atonement for you that you may bless the inheritance of the Lord? And then the Gibeonites said, we have no concern of silver or of gold with Saul or his house, nor is it for us to put any man to death in Israel. And he said, I will do whatever you say. So they said to the king, verse 5, the man who consumed us and who planned to exterminate us from remaining within the border of Israel, let 7 men from his sons be given to us, and we will hang them before the Lord in Gibeah of Saul, the chosen of the Lord. And the king said, I will give them. Serious business, and I've always had trouble really recognizing this passage. This is one that I've kind of, you want to bury your head and pretend it doesn't exist because it's so hard to understand. Verse 1, we find out there was a famine in the land of Israel. Some 3 years. Famines were often, and in this case was, a divine act of judgment from God. 3 years, no rain, starvation, disease. David inquires of God to find out why. Why are you doing this, God? And God says, because Saul had killed some of the Gibeonites. So David meets with the Gibeonites, and the narrator reminds us they were not of Israel, but they were Amorites who were entered into this covenant with Joshua of peace. So in his zeal, Saul had killed some of these people. David asked this Gibeonites, how can I make it right? And he uses the word atonement. Well, what is the price to atone for life? Well, we know from Leviticus that the price to atone for life is with life, with blood. They say, we don't want any money. Oddly enough, the law of Moses prevented buying off or repaying a life with money. They say, we don't want money. We don't want revenge on the people of Israel. David says, what do you want? They say, we want revenge upon the man who tried to exterminate us, Saul. And so they ask for 7 men from Saul's family to be given to them. God, essentially through David, delivers these men to be given to them. And they say, we will hang them in the presence of the Lord. And David consents. As I said, this is a very difficult passage for us to sometimes rationalize and understand through our worldview. And I can't offer all of the answers, but what I can bring to your attention in this lesson is this, that when you make a vow and you bring God into the equation, God takes that extremely seriously. Because this wasn't David seeking justice. This wasn't the Gibeonites seeking justice. Look at verse 14. This was God seeking justice. Then they buried the bones of Saul and Jonathan his son in the country of Benjamin and Zelah in the grave of Kish's father. Thus they did all the king had commanded. And after that, God was moved by prayer for the land. This is judgment from God on a violation of a covenant that was made when his name was invoked. God takes our word seriously. And so should we. This is a statement made by the elders when they were telling the children of Israel why we must now keep our word. They say, we cannot have wrath come upon us because of the oath that we swore to him. What wrath? The wrath of God for breaking a vow that you made in his name. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, because the Lord will not leave him unpunished who takes his name in vain. Thus the famine for 3 years, thus the drought, thus God sees that these men are repaid for their crimes and that this justice is made right. If a man makes a vow to the Lord or takes an oath to bind himself with a binding obligation, he shall not violate his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds from his mouth. It is better you should not vow than you should vow and not pay. God takes our word most seriously. And so in closing, I would make this application and ask you to consider this. You know, there are certain vows throughout the course of our life that we take before God, where we invoke, if you will, God's name, just as these Gibeonites did with David. One of those is the marriage vow. We stand before God, we stand before man, and we promise before God, you know, I'm going to care for my spouse till death do us part, all of these things. So we need to think as spouses, are we keeping our word that we made before God? Because God takes vows in his name very seriously. Someone may take a vow and promise to do something for God throughout the course of their life. If you'll pull me out of this, if you'll bail me out of this terrible situation, God, I promise I'll make my life right. I'll go back to church. I'll begin serving. I'll give you everything I've got. God takes vows made in his name seriously. And when we commit ourselves to Jesus Christ, what we are saying is, you are now the Lord of my life. We're making that vow before God. And that is a vow that God takes most seriously. So we need to think about the words that come out of our mouth, the promises that we make, especially whenever we bring God into the equation, and be sure that we are honoring and that we are keeping those. Because as we see with the Gibeonites, God says, I will not hold those guiltless who take my name in vain. So let's dismiss now with a word of prayer.